Chapter 2, Science and Hope. Two men came to a hole in the sky. One asked the other to lift him up. But so beautiful was it in heaven that the man who looked in over the edge forgot everything, forgot his companion, whom he had promised to help up, and simply ran off into all the splendor of heaven. From an Igloolik Inuit prose poem, early 20th century, told by Inug Pasugyuk to Knud Rasmussen, the Greenlandic Arctic explorer. I was a child in a time of hope. I wanted to be a scientist from my earliest school days. The crystallizing moment came when I first caught on that the stars are mighty suns, when it first dawned on me how staggeringly far away they must be to appear as mere points of light in the sky. I'm not sure I even knew the meaning of the word science then, but I wanted somehow to immerse myself in all that grandeur. I was gripped by the splendor of the universe, transfixed by the prospect of understanding how things really work, of helping to uncover deep mysteries, of exploring new worlds, maybe even literally. It has been my good fortune to have had that dream in part fulfilled. For me, the romance of science remains as appealing and new as it was on that day, more than half a century ago, when I was shown the wonders of the 1939 World's Fair. Popularizing science, trying to make its methods and findings accessible to non-scientists, then follows naturally and immediately. Not explaining science seems to me perverse. When you're in love, you want to tell the world. This book is a personal statement reflecting my lifelong love affair with science. But there's another reason. Science is more than a body of knowledge. It is a way of thinking. I have a foreboding of an America in my children's or grandchildren's time when the United States is a service and information economy, when nearly all the key manufacturing industries have slipped away to other countries, when awesome technological powers are in the hands of a very few, and no one representing the public interest can even grasp the issues, when the people have lost the ability to set their own agendas or knowledgeably question those in authority, when, clutching our crystals and nervously consulting our horoscopes, our critical faculties in decline, unable to distinguish between what feels good and what's true, we slide almost without noticing back into superstition and darkness. The dumbing down of America is most evident in the slow decay of substantive content in the enormously influential media. The 30-second sound bites, now down to 10 seconds or less. Lowest common denominator programming. Credulous presentations on pseudoscience and superstition. But especially a kind of celebration of ignorance. As I write, the number one video cassette rental in America is the movie Dumb and Dumber. Beavis and Butthead remain popular and influential with young TV viewers. The plain lesson is that study and learning, not just of science but of anything, are avoidable and even undesirable. We've arranged a global civilization in which the most crucial elements, transportation, communications, and all other industries, agriculture, medicine, education, entertainment, protecting the environment, and even the key democratic institution of voting, profoundly depend on science and technology. We have also arranged things so that almost no one understands science and technology. This is a prescription for disaster. We might get away with it for a while, but sooner or later, this combustible mixture of ignorance and power is going to blow up in our faces. A Candle in the Dark is the title of a courageous, largely biblically based book by Thomas Adey, published in London in 1656, attacking the witch hunts then in progress as a scam to delude the people. Any illness or storm, anything out of the ordinary, was popularly attributed to witchcraft. Witches must exist, Adey quoted the witchmongers as arguing. Else how should these things be, or come to pass? For much of our history, we were so fearful of the outside world, with its unpredictable dangers, that we gladly embraced anything that promised to soften or explain away the terror. Science is an attempt, largely successful, to understand the world, to get a grip on things, to get a hold of ourselves, to steer a safe course. Microbiology and meteorology now explain what only a few centuries ago was considered sufficient cause to burn women to death. AD also warned of the danger that the nations will perish for lack of knowledge. Avoidable human misery is more often caused not so much by stupidity as by ignorance, particularly our ignorance about ourselves. I worry that, especially as the millennium edges nearer, pseudoscience and superstition will seem year by year more tempting, the siren song of unreason more sonorous and attractive. Where have we heard it before? Whenever our ethnic or national prejudices are aroused, in times of scarcity, during challenges to national self-esteem or nerve, when we agonize about our diminished cosmic place and purpose, or when fanaticism is bubbling up around us. Then, habits of thought familiar from ages past reach for the controls. The candle flame gutters. Its little pool of light trembles. Darkness gathers. The demons begin to stir. There is much that science doesn't understand, many mysteries still to be resolved. In a universe tens of billions of light years across, and some 10 or 15 billion years old, this may be the case forever. We are constantly stumbling on surprises. Yet some New Age and religious writers assert that scientists believe that what they find is all there is. Scientists may reject mystic revelations for which there is no evidence except somebody say so, but they hardly believe their knowledge of nature to be complete. Science is far from a perfect instrument of knowledge. It's just the best we have. In this respect, as in many others, it's like democracy. Science by itself cannot advocate courses of human action, but it can certainly illuminate the possible consequences of alternative courses of action. The scientific way of thinking is at once imaginative and disciplined. This is central to its success. Science invites us to let the facts in, even when they don't conform to our preconceptions. It counsels us to carry alternative hypotheses in our heads and see which best fit the facts. It urges on us a delicate balance between no-holds-barred openness to new ideas, however heretical, and the most rigorous skeptical scrutiny of everything, new ideas and established wisdom. This kind of thinking is also an essential tool for a democracy in an age of change. One of the reasons for its success is that science has built-in error-correcting machinery at its very heart. Some may consider this an overbroad characterization, but to me, every time we exercise self-criticism, every time we test our ideas against the outside world, we are doing science. When we are self-indulgent and uncritical, when we confuse hopes and facts, we slide into pseudoscience and superstition. Every time a scientific paper presents a bit of data, it's accompanied by an error bar, a quiet but insistent reminder that no knowledge is complete or perfect. It's a calibration of how much we trust what we think we know. If the error bars are small, the accuracy of our empirical knowledge is high. If the error bars are large, then so is the uncertainty in our knowledge. Except in pure mathematics, nothing is known for certain, although much is certainly false. Moreover, scientists are usually careful to characterize the veridical status of their attempts to understand the world, ranging from conjectures and hypotheses, which are highly tentative, all the way up to laws of nature, which are repeatedly and systematically confirmed through many interrogations of how the world works. But even laws of nature are not absolutely certain. There may be new circumstances never before examined, inside black holes, say, or within the electron, or close to the speed of light, where even our vaunted laws of nature break down, and, however valid they may be in ordinary circumstances, need correction. Humans may crave absolute certainty. They may aspire to it. They may pretend, as partisans of certain religions do, to have attained it. But the history of science, by far the most successful claim to knowledge accessible to humans, teaches that the most we can hope for is successive improvement in our understanding, learning from our mistakes, an asymptotic approach to the universe, but with a proviso that absolute certainty will always elude us. We will always be mired in error. The most each generation can hope for is to reduce the error bars a little, and to add to the body of data to which error bars apply. The error bar is a pervasive, visible self-assessment of the reliability of our knowledge. You can often see error bars in public opinion polls, an uncertainty of plus or minus 3%, say. Imagine a society in which every speech in the congressional record, every television commercial, every sermon, had an accompanying error bar or its equivalent. One of the great commandments of science is mistrust arguments from authority. Scientists, being primates and thus given to dominance hierarchies, of course do not always follow this commandment. Too many such arguments have proved too painfully wrong. Authorities must prove their contentions like everybody else. This independence of science, its occasional unwillingness to accept conventional wisdom, makes it dangerous to doctrines less self-critical, or with pretensions to certitude. Because science carries us towards an understanding of how the world is, rather than how we would wish it to be, its findings may not in all cases be immediately comprehensible or satisfying. It may take a little work to restructure our mindsets. Some of science is very simple. When it gets complicated, that's usually because the world is complicated, or because we're complicated. When we shy away from it because it seems too difficult, or because we've been taught so poorly, we surrender the ability to take charge of our future. We are disenfranchised. Our self-confidence erodes. But when we pass beyond the barrier, when the findings and methods of science get through to us, when we understand and put this knowledge to use, many feel deep satisfaction. This is true for everyone, but especially for children, born with a zest for knowledge, aware that they must live in a future molded by science, but so often convinced in their adolescence that science is not for them. I know personally, from both having science explained to me and from my attempts to explain it to others, how gratifying it is when we get it, when obscure terms suddenly take on meaning, when we grasp what all the fuss is about, when deep wonders are revealed. In its encounter with nature, science invariably elicits a sense of reverence and awe. The very act of understanding is a celebration of joining, merging, even if on a very modest scale, with the magnificence of the cosmos. And the cumulative worldwide build-up of knowledge over time converts science into something only a little short of a transnational, transgenerational meta-mind. Spirit comes from the Latin word to breathe. What we breathe is air, which is certainly matter, however thin. Despite usage to the contrary, there is no necessary implication in the word spiritual that we are talking of anything other than matter, including the matter of which the brain is made, or anything outside the realm of science. On occasion, I will feel free to use the word. Science is not only compatible with spirituality, it is a profound source of spirituality. When we recognize our place in an immensity of light years and in the passage of ages, when we grasp the intricacy, beauty, and subtlety of life, then that soaring feeling, that sense of elation and humility combined, is surely spiritual. So are our emotions in the presence of great art, or music, or literature, or acts of exemplary selfless courage, such as those of Mohandas Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr. The notion that science and spirituality are somehow mutually exclusive does a disservice to both. Science may be hard to understand. It may challenge cherished beliefs when its products are placed at the disposal of politicians or industrialists, it may lead to weapons of mass destruction and grave threats to the environment. But one thing you have to say about it, it delivers the goods. Not every branch of science can foretell the future. Paleontology can't. But many can, and with stunning accuracy. If you want to know when the next eclipse of the sun will be, you might try magicians or mystics, but you'll do much better with scientists. They will tell you where on Earth to stand, when you have to be there, and whether it will be a partial eclipse, a total eclipse, or an annular eclipse. They can routinely predict a solar eclipse to the minute a millennium in advance. You can go to the witch doctor to lift the spell that causes your pernicious anemia, or you can take vitamin B12. If you want to save your child from polio, you can pray, or you can inoculate. If you're interested in the sex of your unborn child, you can consult Plum Bob Danglers all you want. Left, right, a boy, forward, back, a girl. Or maybe it's the other way around. But they'll be right, on average, only one time in two. If you want real accuracy, here 99% accuracy, try amniocentesis and sonograms. Try science. Think of how many religions attempt to validate themselves with prophecy. Think of how many people rely on these prophecies, however vague, however unfulfilled, to support or prop up their beliefs. Yet has there ever been a religion with the prophetic accuracy and reliability of science? There isn't a religion on the planet that doesn't long for a comparable ability, precise and repeatedly demonstrated before committed skeptics, to foretell future events. No other human institution comes close. Is this worshipping at the altar of science? Is this replacing one faith by another, equally arbitrary? In my view, not at all. The directly observed success of science is the reason I advocate its use. If something else worked better, I would advocate the something else. Does science insulate itself from philosophical criticism? Does it define itself as having a monopoly on the truth? Think again of that eclipse 1,000 years in the future. Compare as many doctrines as you can think of. Note what predictions they make of the future, which ones are vague, which ones are precise, and which doctrines, every one of them subject to human fallibility, have error-correcting mechanisms built in. Take account of the fact that not one of them is perfect. Then simply pick the one that in a fair comparison works, as opposed to feels, best. If different doctrines are superior in quite separate and independent fields, we are, of course, free to choose several, but not if they contradict one another. Far from being idolatry, this is the means by which we can distinguish the false idols from the real thing. Again, the reason science works so well is partly that built-in error-correcting machinery. There are no forbidden questions in science, no matters too sensitive or delicate to be probed, no sacred truths. That openness to new ideas, combined with the most rigorous, skeptical scrutiny of all ideas, sifts the wheat from the chaff. It makes no difference how smart, august, or beloved you are. You must prove your case in the face of determined expert criticism. Diversity and debate are valued. Opinions are encouraged to contend, substantively and in depth. The process of science may sound messy and disorderly. In a way, it is. If you examine science in its everyday aspect, of course you find that scientists run the gamut of human emotion, personality, and character. But there is one facet that is really striking to the outsider, and that is the gauntlet of criticism considered acceptable or even desirable. There is much warm and inspired encouragement of apprentice scientists by their mentors. But the poor graduate student at his or her PhD oral exam is subjected to a withering crossfire of questions from the very professors who have the candidate's future in their grasp. Naturally, the students are nervous. Who wouldn't be? True, they've prepared for it for years, but they understand that at this critical moment, they have to be able to answer searching questions posed by experts. So, in preparing to defend their theses, they must practice a very useful habit of thought. They must anticipate questions. They have to ask, where in my dissertation is there a weakness that someone else might find? I'd better identify it before they do. You sit in at contentious scientific meetings. You find university colloquia in which the speaker has hardly gotten 30 seconds into the talk before there are devastating questions and comments from the audience. You examine the conventions in which a written report is submitted to a scientific journal for possible publication, then is conveyed by the editor to anonymous referees whose job it is to ask, did the author do anything stupid? Is there anything in here that is sufficiently interesting to be published? What are the deficiencies of this paper? Have the main results been found by anybody else? Is the argument adequate? Or should the paper be resubmitted after the author has actually demonstrated what is here only speculated on? And it's anonymous. The author doesn't know who the critics are. This is the everyday expectation in the scientific community. Why do we put up with it? Do we like being criticized? No. Every scientist feels a proprietary affection for his or her ideas and findings. Even so, you don't reply to critics, "Wait a minute, this is a really good idea. I'm very fond of it. It's done you no harm. Please leave it alone." Instead, the hard but just rule is that if the ideas don't work, you must throw them away. Don't waste neurons on what doesn't work. Devote those neurons to new ideas that better explain the data. The British physicist Michael Faraday warned of the powerful temptation. To seek for such evidence and appearances as are in the favor of our desires, and to disregard those which oppose them. We receive as friendly that which agrees with us. We resist with dislike that which opposes us, whereas the very reverse is required by every dictate of common sense. Valid criticism does you a favor. Some people consider science arrogant, especially when it purports to contradict beliefs of long standing, or when it introduces bizarre concepts that seem contradictory to common sense. Like an earthquake that rattles our faith in the very ground we're standing on, challenging our accustomed beliefs, shaking the doctrines we have grown to rely upon, can be profoundly disturbing. Nevertheless, I maintain that science is part and parcel humility. Scientists do not seek to impose their needs and wants on nature, but instead humbly interrogate nature and take seriously what they find. We are aware that revered scientists have been wrong. We understand human imperfection. We insist on independent and, to the extent possible, quantitative verification of proposed tenets of belief. We are constantly prodding, challenging, seeking contradictions or small, persistent, residual errors, proposing alternative explanations, encouraging heresy. We give our highest rewards to those who convincingly disprove established beliefs. Here's one of many examples. The laws of motion and the inverse square law of gravitation, associated with the name of Isaac Newton, are properly considered among the crowning achievements of the human species. 300 years later, we use those Newtonian dynamics to predict those eclipses. Years after launch, billions of miles from Earth, with only tiny corrections from Einstein, the spacecraft beautifully arrives at a predetermined point in the orbit of the target world, just as the world comes ambling by. The accuracy is astonishing. Plainly, Newton knew what he was doing. But scientists have not been content to leave well enough alone. They have persistently sought chinks in the Newtonian armor. At high speeds and strong gravities, Newtonian physics breaks down. This is one of the great findings of Albert Einstein's special and general relativity, and is one of the reasons his memory is so greatly honored. Newtonian physics is valid over a wide range of conditions, including those of everyday life. But in certain circumstances, highly unusual for human beings, we are not, after all, in the habit of traveling near light speed. It simply doesn't give the right answer. It does not conform to observations of nature. special and general relativity are indistinguishable from Newtonian physics in its realm of validity. But make very different predictions, predictions in excellent accord with observation, in those other regimes, high speed, strong gravity. Newtonian physics turns out to be an approximation to the truth, good in circumstances with which we are routinely familiar, bad in others. It is a splendid and justly celebrated accomplishment of the human mind, but it has its limitations. However, in accord with our understanding of human fallibility, heeding the counsel that we may asymptotically approach the truth but will never fully reach it, scientists are today investigating regimes in which general relativity may break down. For example, general relativity predicts a startling phenomenon called gravitational waves. They have never been detected directly, but if they do not exist, there is something fundamentally wrong with general relativity. Pulsars are rapidly rotating neutron stars, whose flicker rates can now be measured to 15 decimal places. Two very dense pulsars in orbit around each other are predicted to radiate copious quantities of gravitational waves, which will, in time, slightly alter the orbits and rotation periods of the two stars. Joseph Taylor and Russell Hulse of Princeton University have used this method to test the predictions of general relativity in a wholly novel way. For all they knew, the results would be inconsistent with general relativity, and they would have overturned one of the chief pillars of modern physics. Not only were they willing to challenge general relativity, they were widely encouraged to do so. As it turns out, the observations of binary pulsars give a precise verification of the predictions of general relativity, and for this, Taylor and Hulse were co-recipients of the 1993 Nobel Prize in Physics. In diverse ways, many other physicists are testing general relativity, for example, by attempting directly to detect the elusive gravitational waves. They hope to strain the theory to the breaking point and discover whether a regime of nature exists in which Einstein's great advance in understanding in turn begins to fray. These efforts will continue as long as there are scientists. General relativity is certainly an inadequate description of nature at the quantum level. But even if that were not the case, even if general relativity were everywhere and forever valid, what better way of convincing ourselves of its validity than a concerted effort to discover its failings and limitations? This is one of the reasons that the organized religions do not inspire me with confidence. Which leaders of the major faiths acknowledge that their beliefs might be incomplete or erroneous, and establish institutes to uncover possible doctrinal deficiencies? Beyond the test of everyday living, who is systematically testing the circumstances in which traditional religious teachings may no longer apply? It is certainly conceivable that doctrines and ethics that may have worked fairly well in patriarchal or patristic or medieval times might be thoroughly invalid in the very different world we inhabit today. What sermons even-handedly examine the God hypothesis? What rewards are religious skeptics given by the established religions, or, for that matter, social and economic skeptics by the society in which they swim? Science, Andrian notes, is forever whispering in our ears. Remember, you're very new at this. You might be mistaken. You've been wrong before. Despite all the talk of humility, show me something comparable in religion. Scripture is said to be divinely inspired, a phrase with many meanings. But what if it's simply made up by fallible humans? Miracles are attested, but what if they're instead some mix of charlatanry, unfamiliar states of consciousness, misapprehensions of natural phenomena, and mental illness? No contemporary religion and no New Age belief seems to me to take sufficient account of the grandeur, magnificence, subtlety, and intricacy of the universe revealed by science. The fact that so little of the findings of modern science is prefigured in Scripture, to my mind, cast further doubt on its divine inspiration. But of course, I might be wrong. Listen to the two following paragraphs. Not to understand the science described, but to get a feeling for the author's style of thinking. He is facing anomalies, apparent paradoxes in physics. Asymmetries, he calls them. What can we learn from them? It is known that Maxwell's electrodynamics, as usually understood at the present time, when applied to moving bodies, leads to asymmetries which do not appear to be inherent in the phenomena. Take, for example, the reciprocal electrodynamic action of a magnet and a conductor. The observable phenomenon here depends only on the relative motion of the conductor and the magnet, whereas the customary view draws a sharp distinction between the two cases, in which either the one or the other of these bodies is in motion. For if the magnet is in motion and the conductor at rest, there arises in the neighborhood of the magnet an electric field with a certain definite energy, producing a current at the places where parts of the conductor are situated. But if the magnet is stationary and the conductor in motion, no electric field arises in the neighborhood of the magnet. In the conductor, however, we find an electromotive force, to which in itself there is no corresponding energy, but which gives rise, assuming equality of relative motion in the two cases discussed, to electric currents of the same path and intensity as those produced by the electric forces in the former case. Examples of this sort, together with the unsuccessful attempts to discover any motion of the Earth relative to the ether, suggests that the phenomena of electrodynamics, as well as of mechanics, possess no properties corresponding to the idea of absolute rest. They suggest rather that, as has already been shown to the first order of small quantities, the same laws of electrodynamics and optics will be valid for all frames of reference for which the equations of mechanics hold good. What is the author trying to tell us here? I'll try to explain the background later in this book. For now, we can perhaps recognize that the language is spare, technical, cautious, clear, and not a jot more complicated than it need be. You would not offhand guess from how it's phrased, or from its unostentatious title, On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies, that this article represents the crucial arrival of the theory of special relativity into the world, the gateway to the triumphant announcement of the equivalence of mass and energy, the deflation of the conceit that our small world occupies some privileged reference frame in the universe, and, in several different ways, an epochal event in human history. The opening words of Albert Einstein's 1905 paper are characteristic of the scientific report. It is refreshingly unself-serving, circumspect, and understated. Contrast its restrained tones with, say, the products of modern advertising, political speeches, authoritative theological pronouncements, or, for that matter, the blurb on the cover of this audiobook. Notice how Einstein's paper begins by trying to make sense of experimental results. Wherever possible, scientists experiment. Which experiments suggest themselves often depends on which theories currently prevail. Scientists are intent on testing those theories to the breaking point. They do not trust what is intuitively obvious. That the Earth is flat was once obvious. That heavy bodies fall faster than light ones was once obvious. That blood-sucking leeches cure most diseases was once obvious. That some people are naturally and by divine decree slaves was once obvious. That there is such a place as the center of the universe, and that the Earth sits in that exalted spot, was once obvious. That there is an absolute standard of rest was once obvious. The truth may be puzzling or counterintuitive. It may contradict deeply held beliefs. Experiment is how we get a handle on it. At a dinner many decades ago, the physicist Robert W. Wood was asked to respond to the toast, "To physics and metaphysics." By metaphysics, people then meant something like philosophy, or truths you could recognize just by thinking about them. They could also have included pseudoscience. Wood answered along these lines. The physicist has an idea. The more he thinks it through, the more sense it seems to make. He consults the scientific literature. The more he reads, the more promising the idea becomes. Thus prepared, he goes to the laboratory and devises an experiment to test it. The experiment is painstaking. Many possibilities are checked. The accuracy of measurement is refined, the error bars reduced. He lets the chips fall where they may. He is devoted only to what the experiment teaches. At the end of all this work, through careful experimentation, the idea is found to be worthless. So, the physicist discards it, frees his mind from the clutter of error, and moves on to something else. The difference between physics and metaphysics, Wood concluded, as he raised his glass high, is not that the practitioners of one are smarter than the practitioners of the other. The difference is that the metaphysicist has no laboratory. For me, there are four main reasons for a concerted effort to convey science in radio, TV, movies, newspapers, books, computer programs, theme parks, and classrooms to every citizen. In all uses of science, it is insufficient, indeed, it is dangerous, to produce only a small, highly competent, well-rewarded priesthood of professionals. Instead, some fundamental understanding of the findings and methods of science must be available on the broadest scale. Despite plentiful opportunities for misuse, science can be the golden road out of poverty and backwardness for emerging nations. It makes national economies and the global civilization run. Many nations understand this. It is why so many graduate students in science and engineering at American universities, still the best in the world, are from other countries. The corollary, one that the United States sometimes fails to grasp, is that abandoning science is the road back into poverty and backwardness. Science alerts us to the perils introduced by our world-altering technologies, especially to the global environment on which our lives depend. Science provides an essential early warning system. Science teaches us about the deepest issues of origins, natures, and fates, of our species, of life, of our planet, of the universe. For the first time in human history, we are able to secure a real understanding of some of these matters. Every culture on Earth has addressed such issues and valued their importance. All of us feel goosebumps when we approach these grand questions. In the long run, the greatest gift of science may be in teaching us, in ways no other human endeavor has been able, something about our cosmic context, about where, when, and who we are. The values of science and the values of democracy are concordant, in many cases, indistinguishable. Science and democracy began, in their civilized incarnations, in the same time and place, Greece, in the 7th and 6th centuries BC. Science confers power on anyone who takes the trouble to learn it, although too many have been systematically prevented from doing so. Science thrives on, indeed requires, the free exchange of ideas. Its values are antithetical to secrecy. Science holds to no special vantage points or privileged positions. Both science and democracy encourage unconventional opinions and vigorous debate. Both demand adequate reason, coherent argument, rigorous standards of evidence, and honesty. Science is a way to call the bluff of those who only pretend to knowledge. It is a bulwark against mysticism, against superstition, against religion misapplied to where it has no business being. If we're true to its values, it can tell us when we're being lied to. It provides a mid-course correction to our mistakes. The more widespread its language, rules, and methods, the better chance we have of preserving what Thomas Jefferson and his colleagues had in mind. But democracy can also be subverted more thoroughly through the products of science than any pre-industrial demagogue ever dreamed. Finding the occasional straw of truth awash in a great ocean of confusion and bamboozle requires vigilance, dedication, and courage. But if we don't practice these tough habits of thought, we cannot hope to solve the truly serious problems that face us. And we risk becoming a nation of suckers, a world of suckers, up for grabs by the next charlatan who saunters along. An extraterrestrial being, newly arrived on Earth, scrutinizing what we mainly present to our children in television, radio, movies, newspapers, magazines, the comics, and many books, might easily conclude that we are intent on teaching them murder, rape, cruelty, superstition, credulity, and consumerism. We keep at it, and through constant repetition, many of them finally get it. What kind of society could we create if instead we drummed into them science and a sense of hope? Chapter 3: The Man in the Moon and the Face on Mars. The moon leaps in the great river's current, floating on the wind. What do I resemble? Du Fu, traveling at night, China, Tang Dynasty, 765. Each field of science has its own complement of pseudoscience. Geophysicists have flat Earths, hollow Earths, Earths with wildly bobbing axis to contend with, rapidly rising and sinking continents, plus earthquake prophets. Botanists have plants whose passionate emotional lives can be monitored with lie detectors. Anthropologists have surviving ape men. Zoologists have extant dinosaurs. And evolutionary biologists have biblical literalists snapping at their flanks. Archaeologists have ancient astronauts, forged runes, and spurious statuary. Physicists have perpetual motion machines, an army of amateur relativity disprovers, and perhaps cold fusion. Chemists still have alchemy. Psychologists have much of psychoanalysis and almost all of parapsychology. Economists have long-range economic forecasting. Meteorologists, so far, have long-range weather forecasting, as in the sunspot-oriented Farmer's Almanac, although long-term climate forecasting is another matter. Astronomy has, as its most prominent pseudoscience, astrology, the discipline out of which it emerged. The pseudosciences sometimes intersect, compounding the confusion, as in telepathic searches for buried treasures from Atlantis or astrological economic forecasting. But because I work mainly with planets, and because I've been interested in the possibility of extraterrestrial life, the pseudosciences that most often park themselves on my doorstep involve other worlds, and what we have come so easily in our time to call aliens. In the chapters immediately following, I want to lay out two recent, somewhat related, pseudoscientific doctrines. They share the possibility that human perceptual and cognitive imperfections play a role in deceiving us on matters of great import. The first contends that a giant stone face from ages past is staring, expressionlessly, up at the sky from the sands of Mars. The second maintains that alien beings from distant worlds visit the Earth with casual impunity. Even when summarized so baldly, isn't there a kind of thrill in contemplating these claims? What if such hoary science fiction ideas, resonant surely with deep human fears and longings, actually were coming to pass? Whose interest can fail to be aroused? Immersed in such material, even the crassest cynic is stirred. Are we absolutely sure, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that we can dismiss these claims? And if hardened debunkers can sense the appeal, what must those untutored in scientific skepticism like Mr. Buckley feel? For most of history, before spacecraft, before telescopes, when we were still largely immersed in magical thinking, the moon was an enigma. Almost no one thought of it as a world. What do we actually see when we look up at the moon with the naked eye? We make out a configuration of irregular bright and dark markings, not a close representation of any familiar object. But almost irresistibly, our eyes connect the markings, emphasizing some, ignoring others. We seek a pattern, and we find one. In world myth and folklore, many images are seen. A woman weaving, stands of laurel trees, an elephant jumping off a cliff, a girl with a basket on her back, a rabbit. The lunar intestines spilled out on its surface after evisceration by an irritable flightless bird, a woman pounding tapa cloth, a four-eyed jaguar. People of one culture have trouble understanding how such bizarre things could be seen by the people of another. The most common image is the man in the moon. Of course, it doesn't really look like a man. Its features are lopsided, warped, drooping. There's a beefsteak or something over the left eye. And what expression does that mouth convey? An O of surprise? A hint of sadness? Even lamentation? Doleful recognitions of the travails of life on Earth? Certainly, the face is too round. The ears are missing. I guess he's bald on top. Nevertheless, every time I look at it, I see a human face. World folklore depicts the moon as something prosaic. In the pre-Apollo generation, children were told that the moon was made of green, that is, smelly, cheese. And for some reason, this was thought not marvelous, but hilarious. In children's books and editorial cartoons, the man in the moon is often drawn simply as a face set in a circle, not too different from the bland, happy face of a pair of dots and an upturned arc. Benignly, he looks down on the nocturnal frolics of animals and children, of the knife and the spoon. Consider again the two categories of terrain we recognize when we examine the moon with the naked eye, the brighter forehead, cheeks, and chin, and the darker eyes and mouth. Through a telescope, the bright features are revealed to be ancient cratered highlands, dating back, we now know, from the radioactive dating of samples returned by the Apollo astronauts to almost 4.5 billion years ago. The dark features are somewhat younger flows of basaltic lava called maria, singular mare, both from the Latin word for ocean, although the moon, we now know, is dry as a bone. The maria welled up in the first few hundred million years of lunar history, partly induced by the high-speed impact of enormous asteroids and comets. The right eye is mare imbrium. The beefsteak drooping over the left eye is the combination of mare serenitatis and mare tranquillitatis, where Apollo 11 landed, and the off-center open mouth is mare humorum. No craters can be made out by ordinary, unaided human vision. The man in the moon is, in fact, a record of ancient catastrophes, most of which took place before humans, before mammals, before vertebrates, before multicelled organisms, and probably even before life arose on Earth. It is a characteristic conceit of our species to put a human face on random cosmic violence. Humans, like other primates, are a gregarious lot. We enjoy one another's company. We're mammals, and parental care of the young is essential for the continuance of the hereditary lines. The parent smiles at the child smiles back, and a bond is forged or strengthened. As soon as the infant can see, it recognizes faces, and we now know that this skill is hardwired in our brains. Those infants who a million years ago were unable to recognize a face smiled back less, were less likely to win the hearts of their parents, and less likely to prosper. These days, nearly every infant is quick to identify a human face, and to respond with a goony grin. As an inadvertent side effect, the pattern recognition machinery in our brains is so efficient in extracting a face from a clutter of other detail that we sometimes see faces where there are none. We assemble disconnected patches of light and dark and unconsciously try to see the face. The man in the moon is one result. Michelangelo Antonioni's film Blow Up describes another. There are many other examples. Sometimes it's a geological formation, such as the Old Man of the Mountains at Franconia Notch, New Hampshire. We recognize that rather than some supernatural agency or an otherwise undiscovered ancient civilization in New Hampshire, this is the product of erosion and collapse of a rock face. Anyway, it doesn't look much like a face anymore. There is the Devil's Head in North Carolina, the Sphinx Rock in Wastwater, England, the Old Woman in France, the Vartan Rock in Armenia. Sometimes it's a reclining woman, as Mount Ixtaccihuatl in Mexico. Sometimes it's other body parts, like the Grand Tetons in Wyoming, approached from the west, a pair of mountain peaks named by French explorers. Actually, there are three. Sometimes it's changing patterns in the clouds. In late medieval and Renaissance Spain, visions of the Virgin Mary were confirmed by people seeing saints in cloud forms. While sailing out of Suva, Fiji, I once saw the head of a truly terrifying monster, jaws agape, set in a brooding storm cloud. Occasionally, a vegetable or pattern of wood grain or the hide of a cow resembles a human face. There was a celebrated eggplant that closely resembled Richard M. Nixon. What shall we deduce from this fact? Divine or extraterrestrial intervention? Republican meddling in eggplant genetics? No. We recognize there are large numbers of eggplants in the world, and that given enough of them, sooner or later, we'll come upon one that looks like a human face, even a very particular human face. When the face is of a religious personage, as for example, a tortilla purported to exhibit the face of Jesus, believers tend quickly to deduce the hand of God. In an age more skeptical than most, they crave reassurance. Still, it seems unlikely that a miracle is being worked on so evanescent a medium. Considering how many tortillas have been pounded out since the beginning of the world, it would be surprising if a few didn't have at least vaguely familiar features. Magical properties have been ascribed to ginseng and mandrake roots, in part because of vague resemblances to the human form. Some chestnut shoots show smiling faces. Some corals look like hands. The ear fungus, also unpleasantly called Jew's ear, indeed looks like an ear. And something rather like enormous eyes can be seen on the wings of certain moths. Some of this may not be mere coincidence. Plants and animals that suggest a face may be less likely to be gobbled up by creatures with faces, or creatures who are afraid of predators with faces. A walking stick is an insect spectacularly well disguised as a twig. Naturally, it tends to live on and around trees. Its mimicry of the plant world saves it from birds and other predators, and is almost certainly the reason that its extraordinary form was slowly molded by Darwinian natural selection. Such crossings of the boundaries between kingdoms of life are unnerving. A young child viewing a walking stick can easily imagine an army of sticks, branches, and trees marching for some ominous planty purpose. Many instances of this sort are described and illustrated in a 1979 book called Natural Likeness by John Michell, a British enthusiast of the occult. He takes seriously the claims of Richard Shaver, who, as described below, played a role in the origin of the UFO excitement in America. Shaver cut open the rocks on his Wisconsin farm and discovered, written in a pictographic language that only he could see, much less understand, a comprehensive history of the world. Michel also accepts at face value the claims of the dramatist and surrealist theoretician Antonin Artaud, who, in part under the influence of peyote, saw in the patterns on the outsides of rocks erotic images, a man being tortured, ferocious animals, and the like. The whole landscape revealed itself, Michel says, as the creation of a single thought. But a key question. Was that thought inside or outside Artaud's head? Artaud concluded, and Michel agrees, that the patterns so apparent in the rocks were manufactured by an ancient civilization, rather than by Artaud's partly hallucinogen-induced altered state of consciousness. When Artaud returned from Mexico to Europe, he was diagnosed as mad. Michel decries the materialist outlook that greeted Artaud's patterns skeptically. Michel shows us a photograph of the sun taken in X-ray light, which looks vaguely like a face, and informs us that followers of Gurdjieff see the face of their master in the solar corona. Innumerable faces in trees, mountains, and boulders all over the world are inferred to be the product of ancient wisdom. Perhaps some are. It's a good practical joke, as well as a tempting religious symbol, to pile stones so that from afar they look like a giant face. The view that most of these forms are patterns natural to rock-forming processes and the bilateral symmetry of plants and animals, plus a little natural selection, all processed through the human bias filter of our perception, Michel describes as materialism and 19th-century delusion. Conditioned by rationalist beliefs, our view of the world is duller and more confined than nature intended. By what process he has plumbed the intentions of nature is not revealed. Of the images he presents, Michel concludes that their mystery remains essentially untouched, a constant source of wonder, delight, and speculation. All we know for sure is that nature created them and at the same time gave us the apparatus to perceive them and minds to appreciate their endless fascination. For the greatest profit and enjoyment, they should be viewed as nature intended, with the eye of innocence, unclouded by theories and preconceptions, with the manifold vision innate in all of us, that enriches and dignifies human life, rather than with the cultivated single vision of the dull and opinionated. Perhaps the most famous spurious claim of a portentous pattern involves the canals of Mars. First observed in 1877, they were seemingly confirmed by a succession of dedicated professional astronomers peering through large telescopes all over the world. A network of single and double straight lines was reported, crisscrossing the Martian surface and with such uncanny geometrical regularity that they could only be of intelligent origin. Evocative conclusions were drawn about a parched and dying planet populated by an older and wiser technical civilization dedicated to conservation of water resources. Hundreds of canals were mapped and named, but oddly, they avoided showing up on photographs. The human eye, it was suggested, could remember the brief instance of perfect atmospheric transparency, while the undiscriminating photographic plate averaged the few clear with the many blurry moments. Some astronomers saw the canals. Many did not. Perhaps certain observers were more skilled at seeing canals, or perhaps the whole business was some kind of perceptual delusion. Much of the idea of Mars as an abode of life, as well as the prevalence of Martians in popular fiction, derives from the canals. I myself grew up steeped in this literature, and when I found myself an experimenter on the Mariner 9 mission to Mars, the first spacecraft to orbit the red planet, naturally, I was interested to see what the real circumstances were. With Mariner 9 and with Viking, we were able to map the planet pole to pole, detecting features hundreds of times smaller than the best that could be seen from Earth. I found, not altogether to my surprise, not a trace of canals. There were a few more or less linear features that have been made out through the telescope. For example, a 5,000-kilometer-long rift valley that would have been hard to miss. But the hundreds of classical canals carrying water from the polar caps through the arid deserts to the parched equatorial cities simply did not exist. They were an illusion, some malfunction of the human hand-eye-brain combination at the limit of resolution when we peer through an unsteady and turbulent atmosphere. Even a succession of professional scientists, including famous astronomers who had made other discoveries that are confirmed and now justly celebrated, can make serious, even profound errors in pattern recognition. Especially where the implications of what we think we are seeing seem to be profound, we may not exercise adequate self-discipline and self-criticism. The Martian canal myth constitutes an important cautionary tale. For the canals, spacecraft missions provided the means of correcting our misapprehensions. But it is also true that some of the most haunting claims of unexpected patterns emerge from spacecraft exploration. In the early 1960s, I urged that we be attentive to the possibility of finding the artifacts of ancient civilizations, either those indigenous to a given world or those constructed by visitors from elsewhere. I didn't imagine that this would be easy or probable, and I certainly did not suggest that, on so important a matter, anything short of ironclad evidence would be worth considering. Beginning with John Glenn's evocative report of fireflies surrounding his space capsule, every time an astronaut reported seeing something not immediately understood, there were those who deduced aliens. Prosaic explanations, specks of paint flecking off the ship in the space environment, say, were dismissed with contempt. The lure of the marvelous blunts our critical faculties. As if a man become a moon is not marvel enough. Around the time of the Apollo lunar landings, many non-experts, owners of small telescopes, flying saucer zealots, writers for aerospace magazines, pored over the return photographs, seeking anomalies that NASA scientists and astronauts had overlooked. Soon there were reports of gigantic Latin letters and Arabic numerals inscribed on the lunar surface, pyramids, highways, crosses, glowing UFOs. Bridges were reported on the moon, radio antennas, the tracks of enormous crawling vehicles, and the devastation left by machines able to slice craters in two. Every one of these claims, though, turns out to be a natural lunar geological formation misjudged by amateur analysts, internal reflections in the optics of the astronauts' Hasselblad cameras, and the like. Some enthusiasts discerned the long shadows of ballistic missiles. Soviet missiles, it was ominously confided, aimed at America. The rockets, also described as spires, turn out to be low hills casting long shadows when the sun is near the lunar horizon. A little trigonometry dispels the mirage. These experiences also provide fair warning. For a complex terrain sculpted by unfamiliar processes, amateurs, and sometimes even professionals, examining photographs, especially near the limit of resolution, may get into trouble. Their hopes and fears, the excitement of possible discoveries of great import, may overwhelm the usual skeptical and cautious approach of science. If we examine available surface images of Venus, occasionally a peculiar landform swims into view, as, for example, a rough portrait of Joseph Stalin, discovered by American geologists analyzing Soviet orbital radar imagery. No one maintains, I gather, that unreconstructed Stalinists had doctored the magnetic tapes, or that the former Soviets were engaged in engineering activities of unprecedented and hitherto unrevealed scale on the surface of Venus, where every spacecraft to land has been fried in an hour or two. The odds are overwhelming that this feature, whatever it is due to geology. The same is true of what seems to be a portrait of the cartoon character Bugs Bunny on the Uranian moon Ariel. A Hubble Space Telescope image of Titan in the near-infrared shows clouds roughly configured to make a world-size smiling face. Every planetary scientist has a favorite example. The astronomy of the Milky Way also is replete with imagined likenesses. For example, the horsehead, Eskimo, owl, humunculus, tarantula, and North American nebulae, all irregular clouds of gas and dust, illuminated by bright stars and each on a scale that dwarfs our solar system. When astronomers mapped the distribution of galaxies out to a few hundred million light years, they found themselves outlining a crude human form which has been called the Stick Man. The configuration is understood as something like enormous adjacent soap bubbles. The galaxies formed on the surface of adjacent bubbles and almost no galaxies in the interiors. This makes it quite likely that they will mark out a pattern with bilateral symmetry, something like the Stick Man. Mars is much more clement than Venus, although the Viking landers provided no compelling evidence for life. Its terrain is extremely heterogeneous and diverse. With 100,000 or so close-up photographs available, it's not surprising that claims have been made over the years about something unusual on Mars. There is, for example, a cheerful, happy face sitting inside a Martian impact crater 8 kilometers 5 miles across, with a set of radial splash marks outside, making it look like the conventional representation of a smiling sun. But no one claims that this has been engineered by an advanced and excessively genial Martian civilization, perhaps to attract our attention. We recognize that, with objects of all sizes falling out of the sky, with the surface rebounding, slumping, and reconfiguring itself after each impact, and with ancient water and mud flows and modern windborne sand sculpting the surface, a wide variety of landforms must be generated. If we scrutinize 100,000 pictures, it's not surprising that occasionally we'll come upon something like a face. With our brains programmed for this from infancy, it would be amazing if we couldn't find one here and there. A few small mountains on Mars resemble pyramids. In the Elysium High Plateau, there is a cluster of them, the biggest a few kilometers across at the base, all oriented in the same direction. There is something a little eerie about these pyramids in the desert, so reminiscent of the Giza Plateau in Egypt, and I would love to examine them more closely. Is it reasonable, though, to deduce Martian pharaohs? Similar features are also known on Earth in miniature, especially in Antarctica. Some of them would come up to your knees. If we knew nothing else about them, would it be fair to conclude that they've been manufactured by scale model Egyptians living in the Antarctic wasteland? The hypothesis loosely fits the observations, but much else we know about the polar environment and the physiology of humans speaks against it. They are in fact generated by wind erosion, the splatter of fine particles picked up by strong winds blowing mainly in the same direction, and, over the years, sculpting what once were irregular hummocks into nicely symmetrical pyramids. They're called Dreikanters, from a German word meaning three sides. This is order generated out of chaos by natural processes, something we see over and over again throughout the universe. In rotating spiral galaxies, for instance. Each time it happens, we're tempted to infer the direct intervention of a maker. On Mars, there is evidence of winds much fiercer than any ever experienced on Earth, ranging up to half the speed of sound. Planet-wide dust storms are common, carrying fine grains of sand. A steady pitter-patter of particles moving much faster than in the fiercest gales of Earth should, over ages of geological time, work profound changes in rock faces and landforms. It would not be too surprising if a few features, even very large ones, were sculpted by aeolian processes into the pyramidal forms we see. There is a place on Mars called Cydonia, where a great stone face, a kilometer across, stares unblinkingly up at the sky. It is an unfriendly face, but one that seems recognizably human. In some representations, it could have been sculpted by Praxiteles. It lies in a landscape where many low hills have been molded into odd forms, perhaps by some mixture of ancient mudflows and subsequent wind erosion. From the number of impact craters, the surrounding terrain looks to be at least hundreds of millions of years old. Intermittently, the face has attracted attention, both in the United States and in the former Soviet Union. The headline in the November 20th, 1984 Weekly World News, a supermarket tabloid not celebrated for its integrity, read, "Soviet Scientists' Amazing Claim. Ruined Temples Found on Mars. Space Probe Discovers Remains of 50,000-Year-Old Civilization." The revelations are attributed to an anonymous Soviet source and breathlessly describe discoveries made by a non-existent Soviet space vehicle. But the story of the face is almost entirely an American one. It was found by one of the Viking orbiters in 1976. There was an unfortunate dismissal of the feature by a project official as a trick of light and shadow, which prompted a later accusation that NASA was covering up the discovery of the millennium. A few engineers, computer specialists, and others, some of them contract employees of NASA, worked on their own time to digitally enhance the image. Perhaps they hoped for stunning revelations. That's permissible in science, even encouraged, as long as your standards of evidence are high. Some of them were fairly cautious and deserved to be commended for advancing the subject. Others were less restrained, deducing not only that the face was a genuine monumental sculpture of a human being, but claiming to find a city nearby with temples and fortifications. From spurious arguments, one writer announced that the monuments had a particular astronomical orientation. Not now, though, but 500,000 years ago, from which it followed that the Sidonian wonders were erected in that remote epoch. But then how could the builders have been human? 500,000 years ago, our ancestors were busy mastering stone tools and fire. They did not have spaceships. The Martian face is compared to similar faces constructed in civilizations on Earth. The faces are looking up at the sky because they're looking up to God. Or the face was constructed by the survivors of an interplanetary war that left the surface of Mars and the Moon pockmarked and ravaged. What causes all those craters anyway? Is the face a remnant of a long-extinct human civilization? Were the builders originally from Earth or Mars? Could the face have been sculpted by interstellar visitors stopping briefly on Mars? Was it left for us to discover? Might they also have come to Earth and initiated life here? Or at least human life? Were they, whoever they were, gods? Much fervent speculation is evoked. More recently, claims have been made for a connection between monuments on Mars and crop circles on Earth, of inexhaustible supplies of energy waiting to be extracted from ancient Martian machines, and of a massive NASA cover-up to hide the truth from the American public. Such pronouncements go far beyond mere incautious speculation about enigmatic landforms. When, in August 1993, the Mars Observer spacecraft failed within hailing distance of Mars, there were those who accused NASA of faking the mishap so it could study the face in detail without having to release the images to the public. If so, the charade is quite elaborate. All the experts on Martian geomorphology know nothing about it, and some of us have been working hard to design new missions to Mars, less vulnerable to the malfunction that destroyed Mars Observer. There was even a handful of pickets outside the gates of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, worked up over this supposed abuse of power. The tabloid Weekly World News for September 14, 1993, devoted its front page to the headline, "New NASA Photo Proves Humans Lived on Mars." A fake face, allegedly taken by Mars Observer in orbit about Mars, in fact, the spacecraft seems to have failed before achieving orbit, is said by a non-existent leading space scientist to prove that Martians colonized Earth 200,000 years ago. The information is being suppressed, he is made to say, to prevent world panic. Put aside the improbability that such a revelation would actually lead to world panic, for anyone who has witnessed a portentous scientific finding in the making, the July 1994 impact of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 with Jupiter comes to mind, it will be clear that scientists tend to be effervescent and uncontainable. They have an indomitable compulsion to share new data. Only through prior agreement, not ex post facto, do scientists abide military secrecy. I reject the notion that science is by its nature secretive. Its culture and ethos are, and for very good reason, collective, collaborative, and communicative. If we restrict ourselves to what is actually known and ignore the tabloid industry that manufactures epochal discoveries out of thin air, where are we? When we know only a little about the face, it raises goosebumps. When we know a little more, the mystery quickly shallows. Mars has a surface area of almost 150 million square kilometers, about the land area of the Earth. The area covered by the Martian Sphinx is about 1 square kilometer. Is it so astonishing that one comparatively postage stamp-sized patch in 150 million should look artificial, especially given our penchant, since infancy, for finding faces? When we examine the neighboring jumble of hillocks, mesas, and other complex surface forms, we recognize that the feature is akin to many that do not at all resemble a human face. Why this resemblance? Would the ancient Martian engineers rework only this mesa? Well, maybe a few others, and leave all others unimproved by monumental sculpture? Or shall we conclude that other blocky mesas are also sculpted into the form of faces, but weirder faces, unfamiliar to us on Earth? If we study the original image more carefully, we find that the strategically placed nostril, one that adds much to the impression of a face, is in fact a black dot corresponding to lost data in the radio transmission from Mars to Earth. The best picture of the face shows one side lit by the sun, the other in deep shadow. Using the original digital data, we can severely enhance the contrast in the shadows. When we do, we find something rather unface-like there. The face is at best half a face. Despite our shortness of breath and the beating of our hearts, the Martian Sphinx looks natural. Not artificial, not a dead ringer for a human face. It was probably sculpted by slow geological process over millions of years. But I might be wrong. It's hard to be sure about a world we've seen so little of in extreme close-up. These features merit closer attention with higher resolution. Much more detailed photos of the face would surely settle issues of symmetry and help resolve the debate between geology and monumental sculpture. Small impact craters found on or near the face can settle the question of its age. In the case, most unlikely in my view, that the nearby structures were really once a city, that fact should also be obvious on closer examination. Are there broken streets? Crenellations in the fort? Ziggurats, towers, column temples, monumental statuary, immense frescoes? Or just rocks? Even if these claims are extremely improbable, as I think they are worth examining. Unlike the UFO phenomenon, we have here the opportunity for a definitive experiment. This kind of hypothesis is falsifiable, a property that brings it well into the scientific arena. I hope that forthcoming American and Russian missions to Mars, especially orbiters with high-resolution television cameras, will make a special effort, among hundreds of other scientific questions, to look much more closely at the pyramids, and what some people call the face and the city. Even if it becomes plain to everyone that these Martian features are geological and not artificial, monumental faces in space and allied wonders will not, I fear, go away. Already there are supermarket tabloids reporting nearly identical faces seen from Venus to Neptune, floating in the clouds. The findings are typically attributed to fictitious Russian spacecraft and imaginary space scientists, which, of course, makes it marginally harder for a skeptic to check the story out. One of the Mars face enthusiasts now announces breakthrough news of the century, censored by NASA, for fear of religious upheavals and breakdowns: the discovery of ancient alien ruins on the moon. A giant city, size of Los Angeles Basin, covered by immense glass dome, abandoned millions of years ago, and shattered by meteors, with gigantic tower 5 miles tall, with giant 1 mile square cube on top, is breathlessly confirmed on the well-studied moon. The evidence? Photos taken by NASA robotic and Apollo missions whose significance was suppressed by the government and overlooked by all those lunar scientists in many countries who don't work for the government. The August 18, 1992 issue of Weekly World News reports the discovery by a secret NASA satellite of thousands, maybe even millions of voices emanating from the black hole at the center of the galaxy M51, all singing "Glory, glory, glory to the Lord on high," over and over again, in English. There is even a tabloid report, fully, although murkily illustrated, of a space probe that photographed God, or at least his eyes and the bridge of his nose, up there in the Orion Nebula. The July 20th, 1993, WWN Sports Urbana headline, Clinton meets with JFK, along with a faked photo of a plausibly aged, slumped-over John Kennedy having secretly survived the assassination attempt in a wheelchair at Camp David. Many pages inside the tabloid, we are informed about another item of possible interest. In Doomsday Asteroids, an alleged top-secret document quotes alleged top scientists about an alleged asteroid, M167, that will allegedly hit the Earth on November 11th, 1993, and could mean the end of life on Earth. President Clinton is described as being kept constantly informed of the asteroid's position and speed. Perhaps it was one of the items he discussed in his meeting with President Kennedy. Somehow, the fact that the Earth escaped this catastrophe did not merit even a retrospective paragraph after November 11, 1993, uneventfully passed. At least the headline writer's judgment not to burden the front page with the news of the end of the world was vindicated. Some see this as just a kind of fun. However, we live in a time when a real long-term statistical threat of an impact of an asteroid with the Earth has been identified. This real science is, of course, the inspiration, if that is the word, of the WWN story. Government agencies are studying what to do about it. Stories like this suffuse the subject with apocalyptic exaggeration and whimsy, making it difficult for the public to distinguish real perils from tabloid fiction, and conceivably can impede our ability to take precautionary steps to mitigate the danger. The tabloids are often sued, sometimes by actors and actresses who stoutly deny they have performed loathsome acts, and large sums of money occasionally change hands. The tabloids must consider such suits as just one of the costs of doing a very profitable business. In their defense, they often say that they are at the mercy of their writers and have no institutional responsibility to check out the truth of what they publish. Sal Ivone, the managing editor of Weekly World News, discussing the stories he publishes, says, for all I know, they could be the product of active imaginations. But because we're a tabloid, we don't have to question ourselves out of a story. Skepticism doesn't sell newspapers. Writers who have defected from the tabloids describe creative sessions in which writers and editors dream up stories and headlines out of whole cloth. The more outrageous, the better. Out of their immense readership, are there not many who take the stories at face value, who believe the tabloids couldn't print it if it wasn't so? Some readers I talk to insist they read them only for entertainment, just as they watch wrestling on television, that they're not in the least taken in, that the tabloids are understood by publisher and reader alike to be whimsies that explore the absurd. They merely exist outside any universe burdened by rules of evidence. But my mail suggests that large numbers of Americans take the tabloids very seriously indeed. In the 1990s, the tabloid universe is expanding, voraciously gobbling up other media. Newspapers, magazines, or television programs that labor under prissy restraints imposed by what is actually known are outsold by media outlets with less scrupulous standards. We can see this in the new generation of acknowledged tabloid television and, increasingly, in what passes for news and information programs. Such reports persist and proliferate because they sell. And so they sell, I think, because there are so many of us who want so badly to be jolted out of our humdrum lives, to rekindle that sense of wonder we remember from childhood, and also for a few of the stories to be able, really and truly, to believe in someone older, smarter, and wiser who is looking out for us. Faith is clearly not enough for many people. They crave hard evidence, scientific proof. They long for the scientific seal of approval, but are unwilling to put up with the rigorous standards of evidence that impart credibility to that seal. What a relief it would be, doubt reliably abolished. Then the irksome burden of looking after ourselves would be lifted. We're worried, and for good reason, about what it means for the human future if we have only ourselves to rely upon. These are the modern miracles. shamelessly vouched for by those who make them up from scratch, bypassing any formal, skeptical scrutiny, and available at low cost in every supermarket, grocery store, and convenience outlet in the land. One of the pretenses of the tabloids is to make science the very instrument of our disbelief, confirm our ancient faiths, and effect a convergence of pseudoscience and pseudo-religion. By and large, scientists' minds are open when exploring new worlds. If we knew beforehand what we'd find, it would be unnecessary to go. In our future missions to Mars, or to the other fascinating worlds in our neck of the cosmic woods, surprises, even some of mythic proportions, are possible, maybe even likely. But we humans have a talent for deceiving ourselves. Skepticism must be a component of the explorer's toolkit, or we will lose our way. There are wonders enough out there without our inventing any.
Chapter 4. Aliens. Truly, that which makes me believe there is no inhabitant on this sphere is that it seems to me that no sensible being would be willing to live here. Well then, said Micromegas, perhaps the beings that inhabit it do not possess good sense. One alien to another, on approaching the Earth, in Voltaire's Micromegas, A Philosophical History, 1752. It's still dark out. You're lying in bed, fully awake. You discover you're utterly paralyzed. You sense someone in the room. You try to cry out. You cannot. Several small gray beings, less than 4 feet tall, are standing at the foot of the bed. Their heads are pear-shaped, bald, and large for their bodies. Their eyes are enormous, their faces expressionless and identical. They wear tunics and boots. You hope this is only a dream, but as nearly as you can tell, it's really happening. They lift you up, and eerily, they and you slip through the wall of your bedroom. You float out into the air. You rise high towards a metallic, saucer-shaped spacecraft. Once inside, you are escorted into a medical examining room. A larger, but similar being, evidently some kind of physician, takes over. What follows is even more terrifying. Your body is probed with instruments and machines, especially your sexual parts. If you're a man, they may take sperm samples. If you're a woman, they may remove ova or fetuses or implant semen. They may force you to have sex. Afterwards, you may be ushered into a different room where hybrid babies or fetuses, partly human and partly like these creatures, stare back at you. You may be given an admonition about human misbehavior, especially in despoiling the environment or in allowing the AIDS pandemic. Tableaus of future devastation are offered. Finally, these cheerless gray emissaries escort you out of the spacecraft and ooze you back through the walls into your bed. By the time you're able to move and talk, they're gone. You may not remember the incident right away. Instead, you might simply find some period of time unaccountably missing and puzzle over it. Because all this seems so weird, you're a little concerned about your sanity. Naturally, you're reluctant to talk about it. At the same time, the experience is so disturbing that it's hard to keep it bottled up. It all pours out when you hear of similar accounts, or when you're under hypnosis with a sympathetic therapist, or even when you see a picture of an alien in one of the many popular magazines, books, and TV specials on UFOs. Some people say they can recall such experiences from early childhood. Their own children, they think, are now being abducted by aliens. It runs in families. It's a eugenics program, they say, to improve the human breeding stock. Maybe aliens have always done this. Maybe, some say, that's where humans came from in the first place. As revealed by repeated polls over the years, most Americans believe that we're being visited by extraterrestrial beings in UFOs. In a 1992 Roper poll of nearly 6,000 American adults, especially commissioned by those who accept the alien abduction story at face value, 18% reported sometimes waking up paralyzed, aware of one or more strange beings in the room. About 13% report odd episodes of missing time, and 10% claim to have flown through the air without mechanical assistance. For nothing more than these results, the poll's sponsors conclude that 2% of all Americans have been abducted, many repeatedly, by beings from other worlds. The question of whether respondents had been abducted by aliens was never actually put to them. If we believe the conclusion drawn by those who bankrolled and interpreted the results of this poll, and if aliens are not partial to Americans, then the number for the whole planet would be more than 100 million people. This means an abduction every few seconds over the past few decades. It's surprising more of the neighbors haven't noticed. What's going on here? When you talk with self-described abductees, most seem very sincere, although caught in the grip of powerful emotions. Some psychiatrists who've examined them say they find no more evidence of parapsychology in them than in the rest of us. Why should anyone claim to have been abducted by alien creatures if it never happened? Could all these people be mistaken, or lying, or hallucinating the same or similar story? Or is it arrogant and contemptuous even to question the good sense of so many? On the other hand, could there really be a massive alien invasion? Repugnant medical procedures performed on millions of innocent men, women, and children, humans apparently used as breeding stock over many decades, and all this not generally known and dealt with by responsible media, physicians, scientists, and the government sworn to protect the lives and well-being of their citizens? Or, as many have suggested, is there a massive government conspiracy to keep the citizens from the truth? Why should beings so advanced in physics and engineering, crossing vast interstellar distances, walking like ghosts through walls, be so backward when it comes to biology? Why, if the aliens are trying to do their business in secret, wouldn't they perfectly expunge all memories of the abductions? Too hard for them to do? Why are the examining instruments macroscopic and so reminiscent of what can be found at the neighborhood medical clinic? Why go to all the trouble of repeated sexual encounters between aliens and humans? Why not steal a few egg and sperm cells, read the full genetic code, and then manufacture as many copies as you like with whatever genetic variations happen to suit your fancy? Even we humans, who as yet cannot quickly cross interstellar space or slither through walls, are able to clone cells. How could humans be the result of an alien breeding program if we share 99.6% of our active genes with chimpanzees? We're more closely related to chimps than rats are to mice. The preoccupation with reproduction in these accounts raises a warning flag, especially considering the uneasy balance between sexual impulse and societal repression that has always characterized the human condition, and the fact that we live in a time fraught with numerous ghastly accounts, both true and false, of childhood sexual abuse. Contrary to many media reports, the Roper pollsters and those who wrote the official report never asked whether their subjects had been abducted by aliens. They deduced it. Those who've ever awakened with strange presences around them, who've ever unaccountably seemed to fly through the air and so on, have therefore been abducted. The pollsters didn't even check to see if sensing presences, flying, etc., were part of the same or separate incidents. Their conclusion, that millions of Americans have been so abducted, is spurious, based on careless experimental design. Still, at least hundreds of people, perhaps thousands, claiming they have been abducted, have sought out sympathetic therapists or joined abductee support groups. Others may have similar complaints, but fearing ridicule or the stigma of mental illness, have refrained from speaking up or getting help. Some abductees are also said to be reluctant to talk for fear of hostility and rejection by hardline skeptics, although many willingly appear on radio and TV talk shows. Their diffidence supposedly extends even to audiences that already believe in alien abductions. But maybe there's another reason. Might the subjects themselves be unsure, at least at first, at least before many retellings of their story, whether it was an external event they are remembering, or a state of mind? One unerring mark of the love of truth, wrote John Locke in 1690, is not entertaining any proposition with greater assurance than the proofs it is built upon will warrant. On the matter of UFOs, How strong are the proofs? The phrase flying saucer was coined when I was entering high school. The newspapers were full of stories about ships from beyond the skies of Earth. It seemed pretty believable to me. There were lots of other stars, at least some of which probably had planetary systems like ours. Many stars were as old or older than the Sun, so there was plenty of time for intelligent life to evolve. Caltech's Jet Propulsion Laboratory had just flown a two-stage rocket high above the Earth. Clearly, we were on our way to the Moon and the planets. Why shouldn't other, older, wiser beings be able to travel from their star to ours? Why not? This was only a few years after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Maybe the UFO occupants were worried about us and sought to help us. Or maybe they wanted to make sure that we and our nuclear weapons didn't come and bother them. Many people seemed to see flying saucers, sober pillars of the community, police officers, commercial airplane pilots, military personnel. And apart from some harumps and giggles, I couldn't find any counter-arguments. How could all these eyewitnesses be mistaken? What's more, the saucers had been picked up on radar, and pictures had been taken of them. You could see the photos in newspapers and glossy magazines. There were even reports about crashed flying saucers and little alien bodies with perfect teeth, stiffly languishing in Air Force freezers in the Southwest. The prevailing climate was summarized in Life magazine a few years later in these words: "These objects cannot be explained by present science as natural phenomena, but solely as artificial devices created and operated by a high intelligence. Nothing known or projected on Earth could account for the performance of these devices." And yet not a single adult I knew was preoccupied with UFOs. I couldn't figure out why not. Instead, they were worried about communist China, nuclear weapons, McCarthyism, and the rent. I wondered if they had their priorities straight. In college, in the early 1950s, I began to learn a little about how science works, the secrets of its great success, how rigorous the standards of evidence must be if we are really to know something is true, how many false starts and dead ends have plagued human thinking, how our biases can color our interpretation of the evidence, and how often belief systems, widely held and supported by the political, religious, and academic hierarchies, turn out not just to be slightly in error, but grotesquely wrong. I came upon a book called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, written by Charles McKay in 1841 and still in print. In it could be found the histories of boom and bust economic crazes, including the Mississippi and South Sea bubbles, and the extravagant run on Dutch tulips, scams that bamboozled the wealthy and titled of many nations, a legion of alchemists, including the poignant tale of Mr. Kelly and Dr. D, and D's 8-year-old son Arthur, impressed by his desperate father, into communicating with the spirit world by peering into a crystal, dolorous accounts of unfulfilled prophecy, divination, and fortune-telling, the persecution of witches, haunted houses, popular admiration of great thieves, and much else. Entertainingly portrayed was the Count of Saint-Germain, who dined out on the cheerful pretension that he was centuries old, if not actually immortal. When at dinner, incredulity was expressed at his recounting of his conversations with Richard the Lionhearted, he turned to his manservant for confirmation. "You forget, sir," was the reply. "I have been only 500 years in your service." "Ah, true," said Saint-Germain, "it was a little before your time." A riveting chapter on the Crusades began: "Every age has its peculiar folly. Some scheme, project, or fantasy into which it plunges, spurred on either by the love of gain, the necessity of excitement, or the mere force of imitation. Failing in these, it has some madness, to which it is goaded by political or religious causes, or both combined." The edition I first read was adorned by a quote from the financier and advisor of presidents, Bernard M. Baruch, attesting that reading McKay had saved him millions. There had been a long history of spurious claims that magnetism could cure disease. Paracelsus, for example, used a magnet to suck diseases out of the human body and dispose of them into the earth. but the key figure was Franz Mesmer. I had vaguely understood the word mesmerized to mean something like hypnotize. But my first real knowledge of Mesmer came from McKay. The Viennese physician had thought that the positions of the planets influenced human health and was caught up in the wonders of electricity and magnetism. He catered to the declining French nobility on the eve of the revolution. They crowded into a darkened room. Dressed in a gold-flowered silk robe and waving an ivory wand, Mesmer seated his marks around a vat of dilute sulfuric acid. The magnetizer and his young male assistants peered deeply into the eyes of their patients and rubbed their bodies. They grasped iron bars protruding from the solution or held each other's hands. In a contagious frenzy, aristocrats, especially young women, were cured left and right. Mesmer became a sensation. He called it animal magnetism. For the more conventional medical practitioner, though, this was bad for business. So French physicians pressured King Louis XVI to crack down. Mesmer, they said, was a menace to public health. A commission was appointed by the French Academy of Sciences that included the pioneering chemist Antoine Lavoisier and the American diplomat and expert on electricity, Benjamin Franklin. They performed the obvious control experiment. When the magnetizing effects were performed without the patient's knowledge, no cures were affected. The cures, if any, the commission concluded, were all in the mind of the beholder. Mesmer and his followers were undeterred. One of them later urged the following attitude of mind for best results. Forget for a while all your knowledge of physics. Remove from your mind all objections that may occur. Never reason for 6 weeks. Be very credulous. Be very persevering. Reject all past experience and do not listen to reason. Oh yes, a final piece of advice. Never magnetize before inquisitive persons. Another eye-opener was Martin Gardner's Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science. Here was Wilhelm Reich uncovering the key to the structure of galaxies in the energy of the human orgasm. Andrew Cross creating microscopic insects electrically from salts. Hans Herbiger, under Nazi aegis, announcing that the Milky Way was made not of stars, but of snowballs. Charles Piazzi Smith discovering in the dimensions of the Great Pyramid of Giza a world chronology from the creation to the second coming. L. Ron Hubbard writing a manuscript able to drive its readers insane. Was it ever proofed, I wondered. The Bridie Murphy case, which led millions into concluding that at last there was serious evidence of reincarnation. Joseph Rhine's demonstrations of ESP. Appendicitis cured by cold water enemas. Bacterial diseases by brass cylinders. And gonorrhea by green light. And, amid all these accounts of self-deception and charlatanry, to my surprise, a chapter on UFOs. Of course, merely by writing books cataloguing spurious beliefs, McKay and Gardner came across, at least a little, as grumpy and superior. Was there nothing they accepted? Still, it was stunning how many passionately argued and defended claims to knowledge had amounted to nothing. It slowly dawned on me that, human fallibility being what it is, there might be other explanations for flying saucers. I had been interested in the possibility of extraterrestrial life from childhood, from long before I had ever heard of flying saucers. I remained fascinated long after my early enthusiasm for UFOs waned, as I understood more about the remorseless taskmaster called the scientific method. Everything hinges on the matter of evidence. On so important a question, the evidence must be airtight. The more we want it to be true, the more careful we have to be. No witnesses say so is good enough. People make mistakes. People play practical jokes. People stretch the truth for money or attention or fame. People occasionally misunderstand what they're seeing. People sometimes even see things that aren't there. Essentially, all the UFO cases were anecdotes, something asserted. UFOs were described variously as rapidly moving or hovering, disc-shaped, cigar-shaped, or ball-shaped, moving silently or noisily, with a fiery exhaust or with no exhaust at all, accompanied by flashing lights, or uniformly glowing with a silvery cast, or self-luminous. The diversity of the observations hinted that they had no common origin, and that the use of such terms as UFOs or flying saucers served only to confuse the issue by grouping generically a set of unrelated phenomena. There was something odd about the very invention of the phrase flying saucer. As I write this chapter, I have before me a transcript of an April 7, 1950 interview between Edward R. Murrow, the celebrated CBS newsman, and Kenneth Arnold, a civilian pilot who saw something peculiar near Mount Rainier in the state of Washington on June 24, 1947, and who in a way coined the phrase. Arnold claims that the newspapers did not quote me properly. When I told the press they misquoted me, and in the excitement of it all, one newspaper and another one got it so ensnarled up that nobody knew just exactly what they were talking about. These objects more or less fluttered like they were, oh, I'd say boats on very rough water. And when I described how they flew, I said that they flew like they take a saucer and throw it across the water. Most of the newspapers misunderstood and misquoted that too. They said that I said that they were saucer-like. I said that they flew in a saucer-like fashion. Arnold thought he saw a train of 9 objects, one of which produced a terrific blue flash. He concluded they were a new kind of winged aircraft. Murrow summed up, "That was an historic misquote. While Mr. Arnold's original explanation has been forgotten, the term flying saucer has become a household word." Kenneth Arnold's flying saucers looked and behaved quite differently from what in only a few years would be rigidly particularized in the public understanding of the term. Something like a very large and highly maneuverable frisbee. Most people honestly reported what they saw, but what they saw were natural, if unfamiliar, phenomena. Some UFO sightings turned out to be unconventional aircraft. Conventional aircraft with unusual lighting patterns. High-altitude balloons. Luminescent insects. Planets seen under unusual atmospheric conditions. Optical mirages and looming lenticular clouds. Ball lightning. Sun dogs. Meteors, including green fireballs. And satellites. Nose cones and rocket boosters spectacularly re-entering the atmosphere. Just conceivably, a few might be small comets dissipating in the upper air. At least some radar reports were due to anomalous propagation. Radio waves traveling curved paths due to atmospheric temperature inversions. Traditionally, they were also called radar angels. Something that seems to be there, but isn't. You could have simultaneous visual and radar sightings without there being any there. When we notice something strange in the sky, some of us become excitable and uncritical bad witnesses. There was the suspicion that the field attracted rogues and charlatans. Many UFO photos turned out to be fakes, small models hanging by thin threads, often photographed in double exposure. A UFO seen by thousands of people at a football game turned out to be a college fraternity prank, a piece of cardboard, some candles, and a thin plastic bag that dry cleaning comes in, all cobbled together to make a rudimentary hot air balloon. The original crashed saucer account, with the little alien men and their perfect teeth, turned out to be a straight-out hoax. Frank Scully, columnist for Variety, passed on a story told by an oil man friend. It played a central dramatic role in Scully's best-selling 1950 book, Behind the Flying Saucers. 16 dead aliens from Venus, each 3 feet high, had been found in one of 3 crashed saucers. Booklets with alien pictograms had been recovered. The military was covering up. The implications were profound. The hoaxers were Silas Newton, who said he used radio waves to prospect for gold and oil, and a mysterious Dr. G, who turned out to be a Mr. Giebauer. Newton produced a gear from the UFO machinery and flashed close-up saucer photos. But he did not allow close inspection. When a prepared skeptic, through sleight of hand, switched gears and sent the alien artifact away for analysis, it turned out to be made of kitchen pot aluminum. The crash saucer scam was a small interlude in a quarter century of frauds by Newton and Gebauer, chiefly selling worthless oil leases and prospecting machines. In 1952, they were arrested by the FBI, and the following year found guilty of conducting a confidence game. Their exploits, chronicled by the historian Curtis Peebles, ought to have made UFO enthusiasts cautious forever about crash saucer stories from the American Southwest around 1950. No such luck. On October 4, 1957, Sputnik 1, the first Earth-orbiting artificial satellite, was launched. Of 1,178 recorded UFO sightings in America that year, 701, or 60%, rather than the 25% you'd expect, occurred between October and December. The clear implication is that Sputnik and its attendant publicity somehow generated UFO reports. Perhaps people were looking at the night sky more and saw more natural phenomena they didn't understand. Or could it be that they looked up more and saw more of the alien spacecraft that are there all the time? The idea of flying saucers had dubious antecedents, tracing back to a conscious hoax entitled I Remember Lemuria, written by Richard Shaver and published in the March 1945 number of the pulp fiction periodical Amazing Stories. It was exactly the sort of stuff I devoured as a child. Lost continents were settled by space aliens 150,000 years ago, I was informed, leading to the creation of a race of demonic underground beings responsible for human tribulations and the existence of evil. The editor of the magazine, Ray Palmer, who was, like the subterranean beings he warned about, roughly 4 feet high, promoted the notion, well before Arnold's sighting, that the Earth is being visited by disc-shaped alien spacecraft, and that the government is covering up its knowledge and complicity. Merely from the newsstand covers of such magazines, millions of Americans were exposed to the idea of flying saucers well before the term was coined. All in all, the alleged evidence seemed thin, most often devolving into gullibility, hoax, hallucination, misunderstanding of the natural world, hopes and fears disguised as evidence, and a craving for attention, fame, and fortune. Too bad, I remember thinking. Since then, I've been lucky enough to be involved in sending spacecraft to other planets to look for life, and in listening for possible radio signals from alien civilizations, if any, on planets of distant stars. We've had a few tantalizing moments, but if the suspected signal isn't available for every grumpy skeptic to pick over, we cannot call it evidence of extraterrestrial life, no matter how appealing we find the notion. We'll just have to wait until, if such a time ever comes, better data are available. We've not yet found compelling evidence for life beyond the Earth. We're only at the very beginning of the search, though. New and better information might emerge, for all we know, tomorrow. I don't think anyone could be more interested than I am in whether we're being visited. It would save me so much time and effort to be able to study extraterrestrial life directly and nearby, rather than, at best, indirectly and at a great distance. Even if the aliens are short, dour, and sexually obsessed, if they're here, I want to know about them. How modest our expectations are about aliens and how shoddy the standards of evidence that many of us are willing to accept can be found in the saga of the crop circles. Originating in Great Britain and spreading throughout the world was something surpassing strange. Farmers or passers-by would discover circles, and in later years, much more complex pictograms, impressed upon fields of wheat, oats, barley, and rapeseed. Beginning with simple circles in the middle 1970s, the phenomenon progressed year by year, until by the late 1980s and early 1990s, the countryside, especially in southern England, was graced by immense geometrical figures, some the size of football fields, imprinted on cereal grain before the harvest. Circles tangent to circles, or connected by axes, parallel lines dropping off, insectoids. Some of the patterns showed a central circle surrounded by four symmetrically placed smaller circles. Clearly, it was concluded, caused by a flying saucer and its four landing pods. A hoax? Impossible, almost everyone said. There were hundreds of cases. It was done sometimes in only an hour or two in the dead of night, and on such a large scale. No footprints or pranksters leading towards or away from the pictograms could be found. And besides, what possible motive could there be for a hoax? Many less conventional conjectures were offered. People with some scientific training examined sites, spun arguments, instituted whole journals devoted to the subject. Were the figures caused by strange whirlwinds called columnar vortices, or even stranger ones called ring vortices? What about ball lightning? Japanese investigators tried to simulate, in the laboratory and on a small scale, the plasma physics they thought was working its way on far-off Wiltshire. But, especially as the crop figures became more complex, meteorological or electrical explanations became more strained. Plainly, it was due to UFOs, the aliens communicating to us in geometrical language. Or perhaps it was the devil, or the long-suffering Earth complaining about the depredations visited upon it by the hand of man. New Age tourists came in droves. All-night vigils were undertaken by enthusiasts equipped with audio recorders and infrared vision scopes. Print and electronic media from all over the world tracked the intrepid seriologists. Best-selling books on extraterrestrial crop distorters were purchased by a breathless and admiring public. True, no saucer was actually seen settling down on the wheat. No geometrical figure was filmed in the course of being generated. But dowsers authenticated their alien origin, and channelers made contact with the entities responsible. Orgone energy was detected within the circles. Questions were asked in Parliament. The royal family called in for special consultation Lord Solly Zuckerman, former principal scientific advisor to the Ministry of Defense. Ghosts were said to be involved, also the Knights Templar of Malta and other secret societies. Satanists were implicated. The Defense Ministry was covering the matter up. A few inept and inelegant circles were judged attempts by the military to throw the public off the track. The tabloid press had a field day. The Daily Mirror hired a farmer and his son to make 5 circles in hope of tempting a rival tabloid, the Daily Express, into reporting the story. The Express was, in this case at least, not taken in. Seriological organizations grew and splintered. Competing groups sent each other intimidating doggerel. Accusations were made of incompetence or worse. The number of crop circles rose in the thousands. The phenomenon spread to the United States, Canada, Bulgaria, Hungary, Japan, the Netherlands. The pictograms, especially the more complex of them, began to be quoted increasingly in arguments for alien visitation. Strained connections were drawn to the face on Mars. One scientist of my acquaintance wrote to me that extremely sophisticated mathematics was hidden in these figures. They could only be the result of a superior intelligence. In fact, one matter on which almost all of the contending seriologists agreed is that the later crop figures were much too complex and elegant to be due to mere human intervention, much less to some ragged and irresponsible hoaxes. Extraterrestrial intelligence was apparent at a glance. In 1991, Doug Bauer and Dave Chorley, 2 blokes from Southampton, announced that they had been making crop figures for 15 years. They dreamt it up over stout one evening in their regular pub, the Percy Hobbs. They had been amused by UFO reports and thought it might be fun to spoof the UFO gullibles. At first they flattened the wheat with a heavy steel bar that Bauer used as a security device on the back door of his picture framing shop. Later on they used planks and ropes. Their first efforts took only a few minutes, but being inveterate pranksters as well as serious artists, the challenge began to grow on them. Gradually, they designed and executed more and more demanding figures. At first, no one seemed to notice. There were no media reports. Their art forms were neglected by the tribe of ufologists. They were on the verge of abandoning crop circles to move on to some other, more emotionally rewarding hoax. Suddenly, crop circles caught on. Ufologists fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Bauer and Chorley were delighted, especially when scientists and others began to announce their considered judgment that no merely human intelligence could be responsible. Carefully, they planned each nocturnal excursion, sometimes following meticulous diagrams they had prepared in watercolors. They closely tracked their interpreters. When a local meteorologist deduced a kind of whirlwind, because all of the crops were deflected downward in a clockwise circle, They confounded him by making a new figure with an exterior ring flattened counterclockwise. Soon, other crop figures appeared in southern England and elsewhere. Copycat hoaxers had appeared. Bower and Chorley carved out a responsive message in wheat. We are not alone. Even this some took to be a genuine extraterrestrial message, although it would have been better had it read, you are not alone. Doug and Dave began signing their artworks with two Ds. Even this was attributed to a mysterious alien purpose. Bower's nocturnal disappearances aroused the suspicions of his wife, Eileen. Only with great difficulty, Eileen accompanying Dave and Doug one night and then joining the credulous in admiring their handiwork the next day, was she convinced that his absences were, in this sense, innocent. Eventually, Bower and Chorley tired of the increasingly elaborate prank. While in excellent physical condition, they were both in their 60s now and a little old for nocturnal commando operations in the fields of unknown and often unsympathetic farmers. They may have been annoyed at the fame and fortune accrued by those who merely photographed their art and announced aliens to be the artists. And they became worried that if they delayed much longer, no statement of theirs would be believed. So they confessed. They demonstrated to reporters how they made even the most elaborate insectoid patterns. You might think that never again would it be argued that a sustained hoax over many years is impossible. And never again would we hear that no one could possibly be motivated to deceive the gullible into thinking that aliens exist. But the media paid brief attention. Seriologists urged them to go easy. After all, they were depriving many of the pleasure of imagining wondrous happenings. Since then, other crop circle hoaxes have kept at it, but mostly in a more desultory and less inspired manner. As always, the confession of the hoax is greatly overshadowed by the sustained initial excitement. Many have heard of the pictograms in cereal grains and their alleged UFO connection, but draw a blank when the names of Bower and Chorley or the very idea that the whole business may be a hoax are raised. An informative expose by the journalist Jim Schnabel, Round in Circles, Penguin Books 1994, from which much of my account is taken, is in print. Schnabel joined the seriologists early, and in the end made a few successful pictograms himself. He prefers a garden roller to a wooden plank, and found that simply stomping grain with one's feet does an acceptable job. But Schnabel's work, which one reviewer called the funniest book I have read in ages, had only modest success. Demons sell. Hoaxes are boring and in bad taste. The tenets of skepticism do not require an advanced degree to master, as most successful used car buyers demonstrate. The whole idea of a democratic application of skepticism is that everyone should have the essential tools to effectively and constructively evaluate claims to knowledge. All science asks is to employ the same levels of skepticism we use in buying a used car, or in judging the quality of analgesics or beer from their television commercials. But the tools of skepticism are generally unavailable to the citizens of our society. They're hardly ever mentioned in the schools, even in the presentation of science, its most ardent practitioner, although skepticism repeatedly sprouts spontaneously out of the disappointments of everyday life. Our politics, economics, advertising, and religions, new age and old, are awash in credulity. Those who have something to sell, those who wish to influence public opinion, those in power, a skeptic might suggest, have a vested interest in discouraging skepticism.